Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of this conversation, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Laura Gomez, author of Inventing Latinos, a new story of American racism, published by The New Press in 2020. Laura Gomez is a UCLA professor and founder of the Critical Race Studies Program in Law. She has written several books, including Misconceiving Mothers and the critically acclaimed Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican American Race. Hello, Laura, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, DJ. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. I'm super excited for you to be here. I didn't mention this earlier, but I am a big fan. I read both your first book, I think it was Manifest Destinies, in my undergraduate upper division undergraduate class, and then again in graduate school. So I've been looking forward to this for quite a while. So thanks a bunch for, again, agreeing to come on.
That's so kind of you. That's so, so wonderful to hear. I do have to correct you, though, because that wasn't my first book. My first book was on a subject that was entirely, not entirely unrelated, but it's a book called Misconceiving Mothers that was about the phenomenon of sort of the invention of crack babies and how that was manipulated to be a war on women of color.
Ah, well, thank you for that explanation. So I had the order reversed. So gotcha. Well, then that actually kind of makes sense, right? In some ways, right? Maybe we can talk about how Manifest Destinies leads to maybe this book. But before we get there, if you wouldn't mind, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I would love to do that. So I thought I might start with my name, because that's something that people always, you know, one of the great things about having a name, Laura, right, is that it's spelled the same and it can be pronounced in both Spanish and English, right? And I've always kind of had that fluidity of having people use the English pronunciation or the Spanish pronunciation and really, really go back and forth. And I like that. I have that kind of fluidity. But the story of my parents and how they named me and my brother, and we're only actually 14 months apart, but how they named us is funny because my name was given to me. Both my first and my middle name, I'm Laura Elizabeth, were both given to me in English. My dad picked the first name and my mom picked the second name, the middle name. And my brother, who was born just a year later, his name was Miguel Antonio. And I was always kind of jealous of this. It's like, what happened, you know, between 1964 and 1965, what kind of was going on? And I think that, you know, what we attribute it to is my father's growing consciousness. He was starting to take some junior college type classes, or it wasn't technically a junior college, but that's what it would be called today, you know? And the civil rights movement was enacted in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And the Black Civil Rights Movement was starting, and my dad went on to start college at the University of New Mexico when I was 2 years old, and he founded and led the movement for the formation of the Mexican American Students Organization, UMAS, United Mexican American Students Association. And, you know, so his consciousness was really changing, right? And you can really see that in the just the different names of myself and my brother. And so that tells you a little bit about my family. And I grew up in Albuquerque, went to public elementary, junior high, and high schools there. And I grew up with a strong Chicana consciousness because of my parents having this political orientation from the late 60s and so forth in sort of at the very beginning of the Chicano movement. But I grew up in a segregated city, right? So Albuquerque at the time was, I lived in the North Valley of Albuquerque, and the North Valley and the South Valley along the Rio Grande were overwhelmingly a Mexican American. And, you know, the hills, we used to call it the Heights. It was just called the Heights. As you went closer to the mountains east, it became whiter. It was like as you went up in elevation, everything became whiter. Now, I have to say, that's no longer the way Albuquerque looks today. But when I was growing up in the 1970s, that's how it was. There was no movie theater in the valley. And there were, it was just like two different cities, right? That was my experience of growing up there. So when I went to Harvard in 1982, I was immediately kind of confronted with this reality that people did not know what I was. Right, racially, ethnically, they did. I was not cognizable in Cambridge in 1982, and partly that's because I have, I would say that if I'm in Los Angeles, people would look at me and they'd say, "Oh, she's Mexican." But if I'm in a setting where there's not a lot of Mexicans, I might be ambiguous, right? So I remember people would say they would think I was Portuguese. And they would say something like, "Oh, Gomes," right? You know. In any event, so when I was at Harvard, I was confronted with this reality of people don't know, you know, who I am, and so I started wanting to study that in school, and I took all these African American studies courses because there were no Chicano studies courses, there were no Latino professors, right? And that was kind of how I made sense of intellectually of this predicament by saying, okay, here's what we know about African Americans. How do Chicanos compare? You know, and that's what I wrote my senior thesis about. And then I went to Stanford, I did my PhD in sociology and my law degree concurrently. So I was doing them at the same time, very much with the idea of what is the intersection of those two fields, those two disciplines, if you will. And so that kind of, I think, gives you a little bit of an introduction to who I am and how I came to my, you know, intellectual and political orientation.
Thank you so much for that. That's just wonderful to hear. I think particularly, you know, just your personal experience, right, being raised by parents, your father, you know, pursuing his education, you know, and the impact that had, you know, on your family and your own experience. I think where you left off kind of dovetails nicely into discussing the title of this book, and if you wouldn't mind maybe connecting it to the previous one, to Manifest Destinies, which I think in some ways has, you know, a similar kind of like underlying theme, right, an argument at least around the creation of the racial category for either Mexican Americans or here in this book, Latinos. But maybe we can frame it around just the question of, you know, what do Latinos, you know, have to do with the story of racism in America, right? Particularly a story that we primarily understand as one that is defined by black and white issues, the history of slavery, et cetera.
That is an excellent lead-in, DJ, because I think that that's the central theme of probably of my scholarship. If you looked over the whole arc of my, you know, I'm in my 27th year as a professor. If you looked over that whole arc, it's really about racialization and how we understand the social construction of race and how we understand racism. And so when I think about this, well, let me just say a few words as you suggested about Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican American Race, which was initially published in 2007. And in that book, I was looking at precisely the question you laid out, which is, well, where does anti-Mexican racism come from? And so I thought, well, to understand that, you have to go back to the root. And the root is the 1830s and the 1840s and the U.S. Quote-unquote westward expansion and this notion of manifest destiny and this notion that the U.S. was, the Americans were the chosen people and they were destined to take over the entire continent. And that leads to the Texas Republic and then Texas statehood and then the invasion of Mexico in 1846. And what that book focuses on is what happens to those people who overnight become American citizens. There were 115,000 Mexicans who were living in that northern half of Mexico that became part of the United States, and they became American citizens. And so that book is really focusing on that story at the turn of the 20th century. But I wanted to continue the story, basically say, okay, let's take it up 100 years and let's look at the turn of the 21st century and what is happening. And then let's expand it from looking at Mexican Americans to looking at all Latinos. What kind of a picture, what kind of a story can we tell about anti-Latino racism? And in particular, as you said, how it is related to, in a kind of a dialectic or kind of a interactivity to anti-African-American, anti-Black racism, which is so central in this country, right? The formation of this country as a racist state, as a racial state, as a slave nation is just, it's, and you know, one of the great things about the timing of the release of Inventing Latinos is that we're now having this national conversation that is long overdue about anti-Black racism. And in a sense, what I'm trying to do in this book is say, okay, where does anti-Latino racism fit in that American story?
Right. But thank you for that. And particularly within the story of, as you just mentioned, with anti-Black racism, there's, you know, as you explained throughout the book, that Latinos occupy a sort of racial middle ground, right, between notions of white and Black and between white and Black populations, and have this very complicated history of how they've chosen to situate themselves, right, within mm-hmm. American race relations. Can you discuss that a little bit about that middle ground?
Absolutely. So for that piece of the story really focuses on the 20th century, right? And so when you think about Latinos in the 20th century, they were basically Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans. And Puerto Ricans, of course, come into the U.S. as a colony in 1898 with the Spanish-American War. And so Puerto Ricans are part of the U.S. from that time on. There were Puerto Ricans in New York in the 20s, right? And that population increases in the hugely increases in World War II, both the Mexican American and the Puerto Rican population. Why? Because there was a labor shortage here, and there was a very direct, concerted, organized effort to recruit workers from those two places. And it succeeded, right? And then, of course, with Puerto Ricans, they had the right to come and stay, and they were automatically citizens, but they were for sure second-class citizens. Now, what this notion of Latinos as a buffer group, you see that in New York. You can actually look at it by census tracts, and you can look at where Puerto Ricans were living and how they were a buffer between Blacks and whites in New York. And you can think about Spanish Harlem in this way, right? And in the Southwest, you can see similar dynamics. It's different, but it's very similar. And in both cases, it's this idea that we are not Black and we would like to claim whiteness. And, you know, I always ask the question, okay, what was in it for whites and for white supremacy to allow those claims of whiteness? And what was in it was precisely this ability to strengthen the oppression of Blacks and the white-Black color line by including in this kind of artificial, limited way, Mexican-Americans and Puerto Ricans. Right. And that's the dilemma that the book really focuses on for Latinos, is when you get to the mid 20th century, post World War II, you've got all of these Mexican American and Puerto Rican veterans coming back and being treated really badly, being discriminated against. And yet they're told that they're white. And it's kind of a cognitive dissonance, right? Like, wait a minute. I'm wearing my uniform and I'm getting beat up. You know, how is it that I'm, you know, how am I getting any advantage of being white? And at the same time, you've got the rise of the Black civil rights movement, and Latinos, Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans really embrace they embrace a movement that is certainly inspired by the African American civil rights movement, which in turn leads to the beginnings of the rejection of claiming that they're white and the embrace of we are people of color, we are racial minority, that starts in the 1970s, right? So you really see that transition. And what I'm most interested in is, well, okay, what's happening between 1980 and 2020? In those 40 years, what is it that we begin to see in terms of the formation of a specific anti-Latino racism?
Right. And so we have, what we see as you're explaining, in the middle of the 20th century, right, you have Latinos themselves that are particularly and predominantly, again, Mexican-Americans and Puerto Ricans that are, right, hesitant to, right, claim or be, identified as, you know, what we'd say term broadly today, people of color, or particularly anything close to being Black, right, because of, you know, their understanding of the racial hierarchy, which led some, not all of the groups, but, you know, some prominent civil rights groups of the eras to actually, you know, make claims to whiteness, right? Mm-hmm. They were certainly tenuous, but they, you know, their effort essentially in some ways towards advancing civil rights or their own causes was actually perpetuating in some ways anti-Black racism.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is related to this idea of mestizaje as well, right?
Yes.
So mestizaje is the concept of, in Spanish, right? That word is the notion of racial mixture. And it has it's not something that fits easily into the American understanding of how racism works, but it is a long part of this history, as my earlier work shows, right? But the idea was that Okay, so let me step back a little bit and just talk about how Spanish colonialism in Latin America worked, right?
Great. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Spanish colonial enterprise was a genocide of indigenous people, as well as an incorporation of indigenous people. And that incorporation of indigenous people, you know, right? So in California, for example, it was exemplified by say the missions, right? And these missions functioned basically as plantations where indigenous people were forced to do labor for the priests. And at the same time, there was so much death, and some of it was genocide, but other parts of it were just disease that the Spanish brought, that they needed a new labor force. And so the Spanish turned very early to African slavery, right? And that was rampant throughout Latin America. So throughout the Spanish Caribbean, throughout Mexico, and into South America, and so forth. And so our ancestry is a combination of that Spanish ancestry, that very large, significant African legacy through slavery, and the very, very large indigenous population. So I kind of lost my track of where we were headed with this, right? Because we were wanting to get back to this kind of in between status that right, Latinos right. have, and you know, the mestizaje has, in a way, it was like when I was growing up, it was very much I was taught to be proud that I was a mestiza, right?
Right.
That was part of the Chicano legacy, just like it was part of the Boricua legacy, right, for Puerto Ricans. But I in this book really talk about how mestizaje, the notion of mestizaje, it was a double-edged sword, because it also implied the disappearance of Blackness and the disappearance of Indianness. You know, like we're all going to combine and we're going to be one beautiful, you know, brown right. person. But the truth is, we have denigrated Afro-Latinos. We have denigrated indigenous Latinos. And I'm talking here about within our group, within our community, right? I'm
right.
not talking
right.
about the outsiders. I'm talking about what we have done to ourselves. You know, one of the first questions that is always asked when a baby is born into a Latino family is, oh, what, you know, are they light? Are they dark? And, you know, right? Like, that's the big
exactly.
thing. And in many families, you see that whole variation, right? If you have enough kids, you're going to have quite a variation, you know, in that, in complexion because of these roots, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that racism, I guess I want to say one more thing, and then I'll let you ask another question, DJ. But I want to link that over to how we think about Blackness in the United States.
Yes.
We think of Blackness as if you have any visible African ancestry, you're Black, right? That's how white supremacy thinks of Blackness, right?
Right. Right.
And unless you can pass for white, you're Black, right?
Right.
And
one drop rule. Right.
Exactly, the one drop rule. And that's not that, which by the way, that's only been the quote unquote, you know, rule of thumb for about 100 years.
Right.
Before that, we had, you know, we counted people who were quote unquote mulattoes, who were quote unquote octoroons in the census, right? In the US census. But that, in order to enforce Jim Crow, right? In order to enforce segregation, you needed to have like a strict rule, right? And so that rule became, if you look Black, then you're Black. You have to ride in the Black car. You can't live in this neighborhood, or you can't go to this school. And with Latinos, it's really been a different kind of both self-conception of race, but also this desire to say, I'm not Black because I'm not going to be treated that way.
Right, right. And equally, tied to the history of mestizaje or racial mixture, right, in Latin America, as you've explained, right, that I'm not Indian either, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was that whole concept and like the nation building projects in Latin America that promoted this idea of, you know, a cosmic race or a mixed race people, thereby kind of attempting to so-called erase racial difference to unite very racially diverse populations, right? That's, you know, the whole project of mestizaje built into, right, the national movements in Mexico and other parts of Latin America. But that kind of, in some ways, I don't know if precondition isn't probably the right word, but that historical experience, genealogy perhaps, you know, is what, you know, Mexican-Americans, Latinos bring into the U.S. racial context as they're trying to understand themselves, and they're seeing how they're being put into this racial hierarchy or totem pole. I mean, they are literally, you know, trained to think themselves nationally as this, you know, in-between people, that they aren't Black, that they aren't Indian, right? So it's not entirely surprising, right, that they make these claims, you know, even though they're treated, you know, as people of color. And doesn't excuse it, but it's just, I appreciate how much you go into explaining the background behind mestizaje and the nation building products, and associate it also with in Latin American countries with, you know, racial whitening, that in Latin American countries, right, you have this concept of colorism where, you know, even though they have very different racial conceptions and they don't exist purely on a Black white, you know, kind of binary like the United States has for its last 100 years or so, it is the fact that the whiter you are, usually the better outcomes you have, right? The whiter you are, right? The more most of the faces you see on TV, you know, even today, right? On Univision and Spanish language programming, right? Are lighter, whiter faces, right?
Right, right.
And so there's that whole history. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's really, that's a really important piece of it. So I was thinking about, you know, one of the ironies of the Latin American independence movements, right? So I was talking about Spanish colonialism, and now you've moved us to the independent states, right? Post-colonial states of Mexico. You look at what was happening in Mexico and Guatemala 100 years ago, and that was the creation of state projects to basically assimilate Indians, right?
Right.
And so you know, you should migrate to the city. You should give up your folkways. You should, you know, right? You should basically become more Hispanicized in the sense of practice Catholicism and speak Spanish, not your indigenous language. Those were particular projects of nationhood, building the post-colonial nation of Mexico and of Guatemala and many other countries. Now, going along with that, in many countries, including those two that I just mentioned, but also Cuba, Argentina, Colombia, other places, there was a explicit national agenda after independence from Spain to recruit white Europeans to their countries. Yes. And Argentina was kind of at one extreme of that, where they did all sorts of things to basically minimize and eliminate the presence, for example, looking at their censuses, the presence of Argentinians of color, basically. But then they really encouraged and gave land grants and, you know, homesteads to white Europeans. And they particularly favored men coming from, say, Northern Europe, who could then mate with the population there and better, quote unquote, better the population, making it whiter. And Cuba did the same thing. They gave land. They gave, you know, like, you can get 100 acres if you're European. And when you look at the Cuban census, you look at this huge migration blip early in Cuban independence, early in the 20th century, of all these Spaniards who went to Cuba. And many of those Spaniards are now in the United States, right? Those families. So you really see a bifurcation in the Cuban population in the U.S., those who came early in the 1960s, right after the Cuban Revolution, who came, by the way, as with the rights of asylum to the United States, right? They came, they were able to become citizens within a year. They received social benefits, including, you know, welfare, including English language training, including housing, including job training, all these benefits that we have never given to Mexican immigrants or Central American immigrants, right? Or Puerto Ricans, even though they were not immigrants, they were part of the United States, right, as a colony, versus the Mariel wave of immigration from Cuba in the 80s, which was mostly Afro-Cubans, right? And so you see these different waves, and you can see that in other Latino subgroups as well. You can see these dynamics play out. But yeah, it is really a fascinating history. And what I'm trying to do in Inventing Latinos is explain and show how this is part of American history, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is some separate story that is, oh yeah, that's cute, that's about Cuba, you know. No, this is part of American history, and it's been part of American history for centuries.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. Well, and as part of both, you know, American history as in the United States, but you know, your first few chapters do a great job of seeing, of also incorporating this as a history of race in the Americas, right?
Yes. That, yes.
You know, the history of race in the United States isn't devoid and entirely exceptional or unique. It is different and it has different features, but it does not, you know, exist in a vacuum, right? Away from the history of colonialism, race, etc., in the Caribbean and Central America, other parts of Latin America, right? That these ideas, right, have crossed borders, right? And moved with people and capital flows, etc., to influence policies. Right,
especially because the borders have changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. This gets me to another question that I have about the role of the important work that you do. The census is key to a lot of the work that you've done and a lot of the work you discuss. I mean, early on in the book, I just remember being struck by, you shared the numbers from a 1646 census in New Spain, which is, you know, modern day Mexico. That showed equal numbers of blacks and Spaniards, right? Mm-hmm. And Spaniards were actually criollos, right? There was actually people that were born right in New Spain, right? The colonies, that is.
Yeah.
And then 10 times that amount, right, of indigenous people, which, you know, this blew me away because I understood the racial mixture, having, you know, done a lot of this reading, but to have it put in stark figures like that, I don't think a lot of, you know, even Mexican Americans or Mexicanos, right, understand, right, yeah, how much of a racial minority the so-called Spanish blood, you know, is or was, right?
Right.
Even so early in that, well, that's roughly 120 years, you know, into the colonial process. But,
right,
you know, that's back in the 1640s. So you can only imagine, right,
what it is now. Yeah.
Right now, or what it was in the 1800s, right?
Yes.
All these ideas of, you know, Herrenvolk, right? You know, Anglo-Saxon racism, yep, are being created, you know, that, you know, just the racial mixture that had been occurring for centuries. And particularly in Latin America and the U.S. Southwest, it was just, you know, indigenous people and you know, African descended peoples, you know, were the dominant groups, right? You know, definitely the dominant demographic figures, right? That have been passed on, so to speak.
You know what I think is fascinating about that, though, DJ, is there were Americans, white supremacists, who saw that very clearly at the time, mm-hmm, like when they were talking about incorporating Mexico in 1848, they said, mm-hmm, that is not a population we want. Those Mexicans are nothing more than this admixture, they would call it, or mongrelization, right? They very understood very clearly what they were dealing with, right?
Right.
You know, so there was this kind of, you know, racist recognition, right, of that, of the truth of that population. And I think that what you just mentioned really puts into sharp relief the projects then of Mexico to whiten their nation, right, in the 20th century, right? So after the Mexican Revolution, right? And we see that, as you said before, we see that reflected today. If you look at Spanish television and you look at the telenovelas or you look at the news, you know, you're going to see a uplift of white Mexicans, right? Phenotypically white Mexicans, not to mention all those with women with dark hair who dye their hair red. But, you know, my dad says, you know, you go to a funeral, a Mexican American funeral, and you look at the pews and you see, if you see all these, you know, redheads. It's like, you know, those dynamics are very, very much still part of our identity. Because again, that's what allows us to claim this kind of, well, we're not Black. But let me go back to what you were leading into about the census, right? Because what's fascinating about that is that, so we don't see, it's not until 1980, as the result of lawsuits over the undercounting of Mexican Americans in the 1970 census, it's not till 1980 that there's a nationwide effort to count Latinos, right, Hispanics, right? And that happens in 1980 and every year going forward. But in each census, since Latinos were counted since 1980, about 40% of all Latinos say they reject so let me step back. So, and a lot of people listening will know this because they've just filled out their census forms recently.
Right.
Uh-huh. Is you have a question that says, are you Hispanic/Latino? Yes or no? And if it's yes, you have to say, you know, a further specification. Are you Mexican American, Puerto Rican, Cuban American, et cetera? And then you go on to the next question. And the next question is, what is your race, right? What is this person's race? And
I hate that question. I always hate that.
Well,
I always hate that second question.
Because a lot of us don't know what to do with it, right?
Right.
We're like,
right. Even those of us that study this, right? Those of us that have been reading about it for decades now, it's like, dang it, there's that stinking race question.
Yeah, because so many people don't want to say that they're white. And I'm not going to go around saying I'm Black because I don't,
right,
even though I know I have African ancestry, right?
Right.
I'm not.
I don't live a black life, right? Yeah, I'm not treated as black, right? That's what we're thinking, right?
Uh-huh. And I don't want to say I'm American Indian, because even though I am indigenous in my origin, you know, I don't want to claim that, because I feel like that's also something sacred and special, and I don't want to, you know. And so I'm one of those persons, and maybe you are too, who checks other. I'm other, right? Well, 40% of Latinos say they're other. They're rejecting all those other racial categories. What we expect to see with the 2020 census is the second largest racial group in the United States will be other.
Yeah, wow.
And it's all Latinos, you know? And that's why there was a plan that was carefully researched and thoroughly researched under the two Obama terms. There was a plan to change the 2020 census to instead fold in those two questions. So there would no longer be that, are you Hispanic or not? But Latino would just appear, Hispanic Latino would just appear as one of the race options. And the Trump administration ended that, or he refused to allow that consideration. And at the same time, the Trump administration wanted to add the citizenship question, which the Supreme Court had to prevent them from doing. And I really see those two things as related, right? They both, they both have to do with suppressing the voice and the power of Latinos. Because I think a lot of people would have been very excited about not having that agony of like, okay, am I other again? But actually having an option that was true to them.
Oh, because it matches what, you know, as you argue in both of these books, right? In this book and in Manifest Destinies, which is why when I read Manifest Destinies, I was like, yes, like someone gets it. We are a race. Like Mexican Americans, Chicanos, we are racialized. We are treated as if we're something different, you know? And that's an experience that I had had. It's this experience that my parents had had, both my grandmother, my mother's mother's side, who's an immigrant from Sinaloa, Mexico, my father's side, who's lived in New Mexico and Colorado for 450 years, you know, that just matched that experience, you know? And I think, as I read it in that book and read it again, this one, like it is what I think a lot of us do want, right? Because it's what we feel, you know, and it no longer puts us that in that limbo of, it, you know, I definitely don't want to choose white, and I don't want to appropriate any type of black or indigenous identity, because not that I'm ashamed of that, as you mentioned, but I don't have that lived experience, right? People don't racialize me or judge me as black or indigenous. It's usually like, what are you? Or you're Mexican, right? Or, something like that. You're Hispanic.
Right.
That speaks to, right, that lived experience that so much of us have. But it also speaks to the issue that I want to get to larger, is this racial project, or the racial projects that states, nation states, that is, are invested and committed to, right? You referred to the United States as a racial state. And so in conjunction of our discussion here with the census, and particularly you just brought up, you know, the Trump and this, those two efforts, right, to both remove, and they succeeded in removing the Latino, you know, race question, but they failed in the citizenship effort. But that was part of this, right, racial project, where the United States is a racial state that is both creating and perpetuating notions of the inequality and differences of races, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Can you speak to that, about particularly that concept of the racial state and how the census ties into that?
Absolutely. So the idea is, you know, it helps for us to think about this in terms of some terminology that is pretty ubiquitous, and that is the terms non-Hispanic whites and non-Hispanic blacks, right? So we have those terminologies precisely because of that dynamic of Latinos who say that they're white, but basically they're not really white, quote unquote, right? And so it's like this subtle way of saying, if we say you're non-Hispanic white, you're the real whites, right? As opposed to the pretend whites. And That has to do with specifically, I think, with this notion of the U.S. as a racial state, as a white nation, right? And so the real whites are the ones who have the ownership of the nation and the claim to Americanness, as opposed to, say, the imposter whites, right? Which is us, right? And so I think that that is, it's also in this whole debate about immigration that we've been having. And what I say is first of all, the immigration dynamic has been part of the national story since the 1830s, when white Southerners started going into northeastern Mexico in Texas, right? And so that's an important historical context. But this notion of whiteness as a, you know, whiteness as a project that's related to immigration and the demonization of immigrants as quote unquote illegals, or those who look like illegals, right? So, and that's anyone who looks Mexican, who is presumed therefore to be illegal, even though 80% of Latinos were born in the United States, right? So,
right, yeah.
So that's a way of trying to forestall the demographic transition. So ironically enough, the beginning to count Latinos in the 1980 census had both the effect of increasing solidarity and the notion of, oh, Latino identity, Latino political power, Latino cultural power, right? As well as the fear of Latino demographics, right? So I'm invoking books published around the turn of the century by Samuel Huntington and Pat Buchanan that demonized Mexican immigrants as basically a threat to the white nationhood, right? To the white nationhood. And I think that Trump has really seized on that in his camp. He didn't create it. It was there. That was already there, but he mobilized it, right, in a very powerful way. And clearly he's continuing to do that because he's running a campaign of fear right now, right? Mm-hmm. He's everything that he's doing, the law and order stuff, the continuing with the immigration stuff, continuing with the, you know, creating MS-13 as if they're this huge, powerful, you know, gang when they're a very small gang that the U.S. is largely responsible for creating.
Right.
Because of the deportation of people back to El Salvador and dynamics there. But he's creating this campaign of fear, and it's fear around the idea of the impending demographic domination of whites by people of color.
Right. Right? Mm-hmm.
The fact that Latinos are going to be 30% of the population by mid-century, that scares people. Mm-hmm. You know, it scares the Trump base.
Yeah. And I think it even, you know, makes, you know, people that aren't, you know, so-called maybe Trump supporters or view themselves, you know, very conservatively in racial or social issues, it does create a side of, you know, uncomfortableness, right, for
yes.
People that see this impending demographic. So, I mean, all the metaphors that are used, right? It's a tide, it's a wave, it's a tsunami, right? Whether we're talking about politics or demographics, these are the terms that are tossed around in discussing, right, particularly in the media and political punditry, right, you know, on the changing demographics and the browning of America.
Yeah, at the very best, it's ambivalence, but it's very often uncomfortableness and fear, right? And so I think that on the other side is that kind of fear and that kind of demonization of the quote-unquote Hispanic hordes as the, you know, we're celebrating or not celebrating, but marking the horrible El Paso massacre this week, right?
Yeah.
That occurred a year ago. And that young man, white man who drove, you know, 6 hours to get to El Paso because he was filled with rage that, you know, quoting Trump, right? Wanting to kill wanting to kill Hispanics because they were taking over. That is the extreme of that dynamic. But the more kind of dressed up version of that is, well, since Trump saying last week, well, the Supreme Court stopped me from including a citizenship question on the census, but what I'm going to do, have my agency do, is when they report the census results, they will not be including immigrants in those numbers, those final tallies, which is ridiculous, and he'll be sued on that. He's already being sued on that. He's going to lose on that. But again, it's this notion of creating that rhetoric and creating that fear. But at the same time, the positive side of all of this is that Latino identity is stronger than ever, because it's like, wait a minute, that's us. That's us. And we're fighting back, and we're creating this. There's incredible renaissance in Latino cultural productivity, right? And this sense of empowerment, and it's happening in politics too, right? So people respond to that kind of racism by saying, wait a minute, I'm going to register to vote, and I'm going to vote, you know, I'm going to turn 18 and I'm going to be voting. And it's having, having a seismic impact in places like Arizona and Nevada, right?
We saw in the last, you know, just 20 years in California, right? Turning from the epicenter of the anti-Latino, you know, movement with Prop 187 to now, you know, a state that's a sanctuary state, right? I mean, unfathomable as I was growing up, you know? I mean, just no way I would have seen that.
Explain that for people, right? So Prop 187 passed by the California voters in 1994. Basically was an effort to say, we don't want to have immigrants in our state, and we don't want immigrants to be getting any protections in public benefits or any kind of rights. And, you know, it was kind of the akin to the Arizona 2010 Show Me Your Papers law, SB 1070. Kevin De Leon, who was the president of the California Senate when the sanctuary state law was passed, basically said, you know, that's what motivated me to become an activist and a politician, right? And so that's a great illustration of that dynamic and how things are changing. And I think that we're going to see that in more and more places. We're seeing that at the national level now.
Yeah. There is an incredible video that was created last year by Latino and Hispanic legislators and office holders in California that's basically thanking Pete Wilson, right?
For starting
this movement.
I remember that. It's really fantastic. That is really,
But that brings us back to the whole idea of also, again, the role of the census in, you know, the racial state, you know, having these projects and what's in it. You even referred earlier in the book to, you know, this is embedded in our Constitution, right? With the three-fifths clause, right? That counted, you know, African slaves, Black slaves, you know, in the census in order to give more representation to the South, right? So that they could preserve slavery, so that they could maintain power, right? In the new nation. That was the only way that they would have ratified the Constitution, right? And that's part of this key compromise. But, you know, since then, so it's really embedded in the DNA, if you will, of our you know, political institutions, you know, that is using race, creating race, and perpetuating racial difference for political, economic, and social gain. And that the state, the nation state, the United States itself, has been right there, right? In, you know, pushing the census, and you go through 150-year, you know, history. It's a nice tight little book. So it's, you know, you go through it, you survey it really well and quickly, but in detail to show, like, decade by decade, here are the racial categories that are being added and why, right?
Oh, thank you for that. I appreciate that compliment, because I, you know, it was hard in a way. It was a hard book to write because I'm trying to cover so much historical ground,
right?
But not in a way that moves in a chronological way, right? So each chapter really has historical context, but I trying to sort of strike that balance between having the history, having enough detail, but really focusing on what that means for today. I think that your history, what you just stated about the history of the U.S. and how we get in 1776, what the racial state is doing, the next stage of that is, well, what happens after the Civil War, right? So 1860s, right? And we actually have, with the 14th Amendment, with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, we have a rewriting of that Constitution, right? It's a completely, it's almost like a new nation is born out of that Civil War Constitution. And the guarantee in the 14th Amendment of birthright citizenship, the guarantee of the vote. Now, not to say that because of those changes in our Constitution, we did great. We know we didn't, right? But we know that that made us closer to having a equal and just society. Now, what I think is interesting is that who is the group now that's being targeted? Well, in terms of birthright citizenship being questioned, that's aimed at Latinos, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
Who is it that is being targeted in terms of this notion of, well, let's not count citizens in the census, let's not count them in the tally, it's Latinos, right? And so we're kind of at another inflection point now of really the nation having to grapple with, are we going to be closer to our, you know, are we going to kind of try to kind of further this idealism of equality, or are we going to, you know, which racial state are we going to be? Are we going to be the more authoritarian and crude one? Are we going to be one that is moving toward some level of equal justice? And I think it, you know, I think that in that sense, the book comes at a good time for us to talk about how Latinos want to show up in the movement for African American reparations, as well as in the beginning the conversation of reparations for Latinos as well.
Great. Yeah. No, I appreciate you bringing that up too. In that aspect of, right, the racial state can function in two ways, right? It can be an oppressive racial state, or it can be one that actually is using, right, racial categorization, statistics, etc., in order to pursue anti-racist, right, policy to
promote
equality, right, to live up, as you say, you know, to the ideals, all right? If, you know, there is something to the founding ideals, you know, of political equality, natural rights, you know, sovereignty of the people, etc., that are embedded within our documents, right, that is an opportunity. And you posit at the end of your book that we are at this crossroads, right? We are currently at that moment, right, in both race relations and policy, and the U.S. as a racial state, for trying to decide what type of nation do we want to be moving forward.
Correct. Yeah. And I really feel like it's like, you know, it's going to, what happens in this next, let's say, the next 10 or so years is going to be really formative in terms of what that next era looks like, right? So are we going to try to have like, and I think this is true for reparations, the reparations for African Americans as well, right? Sort of what we do in this next decade is going to be critical. And that's why this election matters so much, right? What is the choice going to be? And then it's very likely that if we do have a President Biden, you know, he's already said he's only going to be running for one term. So then who is that next president going to be, and how is this, how is the nation going to turn forward rather than backward, right, with this new demographic reality?
Exactly. Well, and I'm not going to give away your book, but I am going to just entice our listeners by letting them know that you do have prescriptions or suggestions, right? Policy suggestions of things that can actually be done. So you don't just leave, us all hanging with some kind of like rhetorical questions, but you lay out, right, several suggestions, as you mentioned, discussed reparations for African Americans, but particularly what reparations would look like for Latinos, right? And how to achieve that type of society. So I'm going to plug that.
That's a little teaser.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you're interested in that. And that's one thing I love about, frankly, sociologists and, social scientists, my discipline as a historian, we don't really delve into, right, trying to prescribe any, policy suggestions generally. We kind of let our historical analysis and interpretation, sit for itself.
Right.
I do very much appreciate the mix that you provide in this book, a glance into the past and an understanding of the important context that shapes, our present, and then moving forward, giving us really what can we do? What are things that could be done, right, to achieve those ideals and to not be stuck in this, this conundrum anymore, right?
I appreciate that you've really been a great reader and a great questions. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you again, Laura, for coming on New Books in Latino Studies, for your time, for the effort to produce this book. I mean, you mentioned in the beginning of it also that it was quite the journey due to a lot of administrative commitments that you've had at UCLA, but you stayed committed to this work, and it is incredibly important for our moment as we've mentioned earlier, a kind of re-emergence of a national conversation around race, particularly around anti-blackness, and it's again it's important for both Latinos and Hispanics ourselves to understand, right, how we fit into this, but also for the nation itself, to understand where Latinos fit in, with anti-Black racism, and that there is this existence of anti-Latino racism, which is often dismissed because it's usually converges into other issues of either foreignness or immigration, and that's usually what's used to dismiss. So like, oh, we're not talking about race here. We're talking about, right, the law and citizenship, mm-hmm. right? When really we are, right? We are talking about race, when you're talking about citizenship, when you're talking about immigration. And your book is just so important to all these different conversations. So thank you again for coming on and for writing this wonderful book.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.